This is cassette number 13.
As far south as they were in the old world, it never got cold enough for water to freeze. People only blinked dumbly when he spoke of snow. When Richard explained snow as flakes of frozen white water that fell from the sky and covered the ground with a cottony blanket, some people turned huffy, thinking he was making a joke at their expense. He knew that back home winter would be raging. Despite the turmoil around him, Richard felt an inner tranquility knowing that Kalin was most likely to be warm and snug in the house he had built. In that light, nothing in his new life was of enough importance to distress him. She had food to eat, firewood to keep her warm, and Kara for company. For now, she was safe. Winter was wearing on, and in spring she would be able to leave. But for now, Richard was confident that she was safe. That and his thoughts and memories of her were his only solace. People without rooms huddled in the alleyways using whatever scrap of solid material they could find to prop up over themselves for a roof. Walls were fashioned from sodden blankets. He supposed that he and Nikki could continue to do the same, but he feared Nikki falling ill in the cold and wet, feared that then Kalin too would fall ill. Nikki checked the paper she carried. "These places on this register they gave us are all supposed to be available for people newly arrived, not just for people on a list. They need workers. They should be more diligent in seeing to it that places are available. Do you see, Richard? Do you see how hard it is for ordinary people to get along in life?" Richard, hands shoved in his pockets, shoulders hunched against the wind and rain, asked, "So, how do we get on a list?"
"We will have to go to a lodging office and request a room. They can put us on the housing list."
It sounded simple, but matters were proving far more complex than they sounded. "If there aren't enough rooms, how will being on a list get us a place to stay?
People die all the time."
"There's work here. That's why we came. That's why everyone else has come. I'll work hard, and then we can afford to pay more. We still have a little money. We just need to find a place that wants to rent a room for the right price, without all this list foolishness."
"Really, Richard, are you that inhumane? How would those less fortunate ever get rooms then? The order sets the prices to stop profiteers. They make sure there is no favoritism. That makes it fair for all. We just need to get on a list for a room, and then everything will be fine."
Watching the glistening cobbles before him as he walked, Richard wondered how long they would be without a place until their name worked its way to the top of a list. It looked to him as if a lot of people would need to die before his and Nikki's names came up for a room, with more yet waiting in turn for them to die. He stepped first to one side and then the other, to avoid bumping into the river of people swirling past, making their way in the opposite direction while trying to stay out of the mud of the street. He considered again staying outside the city. A lot of people did that. But there were outlaws and desperate people aplenty who preyed on those who were forced to stay out in the open, where there were no city guards. Were Nikki not opposed to the idea, Richard would have found a place farther out and built a shelter, perhaps with some other people, so that they could together discourage trouble. Nikki wasn't interested in the idea. Nikki wanted to be in the city. Multitudes came to the city looking for a better life. There were lists to get on and lines to wait in to see official people. You had a better chance of doing those things if you had a room in the city, she said. It was getting late in the day. The line at the bakery was out the door and partway down the block. "Why are all these people in line?" Richard whispered to Nikki. It was the same every day when they went to buy bread. She shrugged.
"I guess there aren't enough bakeries.
Seems like with all the customers, more people would want to open bakeries." Nikki leaned close, a scolding scowl darkening her brow.
"The world isn't as simple as you would like it to be, Richard. It used to be that way in the old world. Man's evil nature was allowed to flourish. People set their own prices for goods, with greed being their only interest, not the good of their fellow man. Only the well-to-do could afford to buy bread. Now the order sees to it that everyone gets needed goods for a fair price. The order cares about everyone, not just those with unfair advantages.
She always seemed so impassioned when she spoke about the evil nature of people. Richard wondered why a sister of the dark would care about evil, but he didn't bother to ask. The line wasn't moving very fast. The woman in front of him, suspicious of their whispering, scowled back over her shoulder. Richard met her glare with a broad smile.
"Good afternoon, ma'am."
Her somber scowl faltered in the light of his beaming grin. "We're new in town," he gestured behind. "My wife and I. I'm looking for work. We need a room, though. Would you know how a young couple, strangers to the city, could go about getting a room?"
She half turned, holding her canvas bag in both hands, letting it pull her arms straight as she leaned her shoulders against the wall. Her bag held only a yellow wedge of cheese.
Richard's smile and his friendly conversational tone, artificial though they were apparently so out of the ordinary that she seemed unable to maintain her gruff demeanor.
"You have to have a job if you hope to get a room. There aren't enough rooms in the city, what with all the new workers come for the abundance provided by the wisdom of the order. If you're able-bodied, you need to have work. Then they'll put your name on the list."
Richard scratched his head and kept smiling as the line slowly shuffled along.
"I'm eager to work." "Easier to get a room if you can't work," the woman confided.
"But I thought you just said you had to have a job if you were to have any hope of getting a room."
"That's true. If you're able, like you look to be. Those folks with a greater need, because they can't do for themselves, are rightly entitled to benevolence and to be put higher on the list. Like my husband, the poor man. He's afflicted terrible-like with consumption."
"I'm so sorry," Richard said. She nodded with the weight of her burden.
"It's mankind's wretched lot to suffer. Nothing can be done about it, so there's no use trying. Only in the next life will we get our reward. In this life, it's the duty of every person with ability to help those unfortunate souls with needs. In that way, the able earn their reward in their next life."
Richard didn't argue. She shook a finger at him.
"Those who can work owe it to those who can't to do their best for the good of all."
"I can work," Richard assured her. "We're from a little place. We're simple folks from farming stock. We don't know much about how to go about things like getting work in the city."
"The order has brought the people a great abundance of work," a man behind Nicky said, drawing Richard's attention.
The man's oiled canvas coat was buttoned tight at his throat. His big brown eyes blinked slowly like a cow as it chewed its cud. The way his jaw wobbled sideways as he spoke only added to the impression.
"The order welcomes all workers to our struggle, but you must be mindful of the needs of others, as the Creator himself wishes, and go about getting work in the proper fashion."
Richard, his stomach grumbling with hunger, listened as the man explained.
"You first need to belong to a citizen workers group. They protect the rights of citizens of the order. You'll have to go before a review assembly for approval to join the workers group, and a fitness panel to hear from a spokesman from the workers' citizen group who can vouch for you. You must do this before you can go for a job."
"Why can't I just go to a place and show myself? Why can't they hire me if I fit their needs?"
"Just because you're from the country. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be mindful of contributing toward the greater good of the order."
"Of course not," Richard said. "I've always worked for myself, though. Farming to bring food to my fellow man, as is our duty. I don't know how businesses do things." The big brown eyes paused their blinking. The man peered suspiciously for a moment, then his eyes finally went moony again. His jaw resumed its wobbling as he chewed his words.
"It's the primary responsibility of business to be sensitive to the needs of the people, to contribute to the public welfare, to be equitable. The review board helps see to this. There is much more involved than the narrow goals of businesses."
"I see," Richard said.
"Well, I'd be grateful if you could tell me how to go about it properly. He glanced briefly at Nicky.
I want to be a good citizen and do things right.
By the man's pride in the explanation, and the way his big eyes blinked faster as he laid it all out, Richard expected that the man was somehow involved in the labyrinthine process. Richard didn't ask how you got a spokesman from the Workers' Citizens Group to vouch for you. The line inched forward as the man explained the finer details of different sorts of work, what each required, and how it was all for the benefit of those living within the order and under the grace of the Creator. As he droned on, delivering his information with smug satisfaction, Nicky watched Richard discreetly and without comment as he listened to the procedures. She looked as if she was expecting him to suddenly turn from polite to deadly. Richard knew there could be no point to a battle with this man, so he remained polite. It turned out that the man named Mr. Gudgeons seemed to know the most about the quarry workers. Since Richard knew little about quarries, he passed the time as they stood in line by asking a few questions that pleased Mr. Gudgeons to answer at great length. The store ran out of bread and closed before they got any. The line of people dissolved into the downpour, mumbling to one another as they went about their woeful lot in life. Richard thanked the woman and Mr. Gudgeons before he and Nicky moved on. Richard paused at a cross street while Nicky studied her paper with the list of rooms. All around, the blocky shapes of buildings rose out of the gloom. Red paint on the side of one brick building was so faded that it left the figure painted there looking like a blushing ghost. The faded whitewash of words beneath the vanishing man were no longer legible. Passing men gazed at Nicky in her wet, clinging clothes, never seeing her face. Her hair was plastered to her skull, her jaw quivered, and her hands trembled, yet she didn't complain about the cold as did everyone else. They had been told that they couldn't get another list with any new rooms that might have recently become available until the next day. So Nicky was trying to keep this one whole, but in the rain, it was a losing battle. Mangy horses slogged through the mud, some of the wagons they pulled squeaking and groaning under the weight of a load. Only the main thoroughfares, like the one they were on, were wide enough to allow teams of horses and full-size wagons to easily pass in both directions. Some streets were only wide enough for wagons to go in one direction. Some of those, with no room to pull aside, were choked off by broken-down wagons. Richard saw a dead horse in one narrow street, a rotting animal attended by a cloud of flies, still hitched to its wagon as it awaited someone to come haul it away. The blocked streets only added to the congestion of the others. Some streets were wide enough only for handcarts. In many of the narrower passageways, only foot traffic could fit. The smell of garbage and the stench of streets that also functioned as open sewers had been enough to gag Richard for the first week until he'd become numb to it. The alleyways where he and Nicky had slept were the worst. The rain only served to flush the filth out of every hole and carry it out into the open, but at least as long as he was standing it washed off some of the dirt. All the cities Richard had seen after they'd entered the old world and traveled south from Tanimura were similar to this one, all suffering under grinding poverty and inhuman conditions. Everything seemed caught in a timeless trap, a morass of rot, as if the cities had once been vibrant with life and people striving to fulfill dreams, had once been places of hope and ambition, but somewhere the dreams had disintegrated into a gray pall of stagnation and decay. No one seemed to much care. Everyone seemed in a daze, biding their time, waiting for their lot in life to improve without even having a concept of the shape of that better life, or how it might come to be. They existed on disembodied faith, confident only that the afterlife would be perfect. The cities Richard had seen were startlingly similar to what Richard envisioned the future held for the new world under the yoke of the Order. This place, though, was the single largest city Richard had ever seen. He would never have believed the size of it had he not seen it himself. Dilapidated buildings entangled by streets, teeming with people, sprawled over a sweep of low hills, across a broad bottomland, for miles along the convergence of two rivers. Squat ramshackle huts built haphazardly of wattle and daub, Scraps of wood or salvaged mud and straw bricks beset the city's core to a great distance out into the surrounding land, like fetid scum surrounding a rotting log in a stagnant pond. It was the city of Al-Turang, the namesake of the land which was now the heart of the old world and the imperial order, the home city of Emperor Jagang. When they had first entered the old world on their way south toward Al-Turang, Richard and Nicky had stopped at the northernmost large city in the old world, Tanamura, where the Palace of the Prophets had once stood. Tanamura, one of the last places in the old world to fall under the rule of the Imperial Order, was a grand place, with wide boulevards lined with trees and ornate buildings soaring several stories high, faced with columns and arches and windows that let in the light. Tanamura, as large as it was, turned out to be but an outpost of the old world, far enough away that the rot was only now reaching it. For a span of a little over a month, Richard had found work in Tanamura as a mason's tender, one of a dozen, hauling stone and mixing mortar for a squat, unattractive building. The masons had simple huts the workers and their families lived in, so Nicky had shelter. The master came to trust Richard to keep up with his masons. When one of the stone cutters fell sick, Richard was asked to stand in at squaring the blocks of granite for the masons. He found holding a chisel and mallet in his hands, cutting stone, shaping it to his will, a revelation. In some ways it was like carving wood, but somehow much more. From time to time the master stood with fists on his hips, watching Richard chisel square edges into the hard granite. Occasionally, in a gruff voice, he would make minor corrections to Richard's method. After a time, as the master saw that Richard took to the job and could cut a block square and true, he no longer bothered watching. Before long, Richard's blocks were chosen first by the masons as cornerstones. Other stone cutters arrived to do more demanding work, the adornments. When they had first shown up, Richard had been eager to see their work. They cut into the face of blocks meant to surround the entrance a large flame representing the light of the Creator. Below that, they carved a crowd of cowering people. Richard had seen a number of stone carvings in the various places he had been, from the Confessor's Palace in Adendril to the People's Palace in Dahara, but he had never seen anything like the figures he saw being cut on that building in Tanamura. They were not graceful or grand or inspiring, but just the opposite. They were distorted, thick-limbed, cringing figures, recoiling below the light. Richard was told by one of the artisans that this was the only proper representation of mankind, profane, hideous, sinful. Richard kept his mind on cutting square stones. When the stonework to the Order's headquarters building was finished, the job ended. The carpenters didn't need any more help. The artisan said they could use some assistance carving the anguish of mankind and offered Richard the work. He declined, telling them that he had no ability for carving. Besides, Nicky had been eager to move on. Tanamura had only been a place to earn some money to buy provisions for the long journey ahead of them. Richard was glad to be away from the depressing sight of the carving going on. Along the way southeast to Al-Turang, in the cities they passed through, Richard saw many carvings on buildings, and many more freestanding in public squares or in front of entrances. They depicted horrors. People being whipped by a grinning keeper of the underworld, people stabbing out their own eyes, suffering people twisted, deformed, and crippled, people like packs of dogs running on all fours, attacking women and children, people reduced to walking skeletons or covered in sores, woeful people throwing themselves into graves. In most such scenes, the pitiful people were watched over by the light of the all-perfect Creator represented by the flame. The old world was a celebration of misery. Along the way south, they had stopped in a number of cities when Richard could find menial work, temporary enough not to require waiting on lists. He and Nicky went for stretches eating cabbage soup that was mostly water. Sometimes they had rice or lentils or buckwheat mush, and on occasion the luxury of salt pork. Sometimes Richard was able to catch fish, birds, or the odd hare. Living off the land in the old world, though, was difficult. A lot of other people had the same idea. They both had gotten thinner on their long march. Richard began to understand the carvings of the skeletal people. Nicky had set their destination but dictated little else, leaving most decisions to him, complying without complaint. Week in and week out, they walked, occasionally paying a few copper pennies to ride in wagons headed their way. They crossed rivers straddled by cities large enough to have numbers of stone bridges and went through town after town. There were vast fields of wheat, millet, sunflower, and any number of other crops, though much of the land lay fallow. They saw flocks of sheep and herds of cattle. Farmers sold the travelers goat cheese and milk. Ever since the gift had awakened in him, Richard was able to eat meat only when not doing any fighting. He thought it might be part of the requirement to balance his need to sometimes take life. Since he wasn't doing any fighting, he could eat meat without it making him sick. Unfortunately, they could rarely afford meat. Cheese, which he had once loved, he could hardly stomach, since his gift had come to life in him. Unfortunately, it was often eat cheese or starve. But it was the size of the old world, and in particular its population, that most unsettled him. Richard had naively thought that the new and the old worlds must be somewhat alike. They were not. The new world was but a flea on the back of the old. From time to time on their journey south, vast columns of men-at-arms moved past them on their way north to the Midlands. Several times it had taken days for all the soldiers to march past. Whenever he saw the rank upon rank of troops, he felt a wave of relief that Kaelin was trapped in their mountain home. He would hate to think of her fighting in an army facing as many men as he saw going to the war. By spring, when she could finally get out of the mountain home and all those Imperial Order troops could truly begin their siege of the New World, whatever resistance the Dharan Empire put up would be crushed. Richard hoped General Rybish chose not to go up against the Order. He hated to think of all those brave men being slaughtered under the weight of the coming onslaught. At one small city, Nicky had gone to a stream to wash their clothes while Richard worked the day mucking out stalls at a large stable. A number of officials had come to town, and there were more horses than the stable master could handle. Richard had been at the right place at the right time to get the job. Not long after the officials arrived and took all the rooms at the inns, a large unit of the Imperial Order troops marched in behind them and set up camp at the city limits. Fortunately, Nicky was on the other side of the city doing their washing. Unfortunately, a squad of men passing through the city and doing some drinking decided to accept volunteers. Richard kept his head down as he carried water to the horses, but the sergeant saw him. At the wrong place, at the wrong time, Richard was volunteered into the Imperial Order. The new volunteers were quartered in the center of the immense encampment. That night, after it was dark and most of the men were asleep, Richard unvolunteered himself. It took him until 3 hours before sunrise to extract himself from his service to the Imperial Order. Nicky had gone to the stable and found out what had happened to him. Richard found her at their camp, pacing in the darkness. They quickly collected their things and marched south for the rest of the night. They went cross-country, since the moon was out rather than on the roads, in case a patrol came looking for him. From then on, whenever Richard saw soldiers, he did his best to become invisible. In general, though, it wasn't a serious concern. Hordes of youths, lusting after the promise of plunder, were only too eager to join the army. They often had to wait weeks or months to be accepted into training, so many were the numbers joining. Richard had seen crowds of them in the cities, playing games, gambling, drinking, fighting, young men dreaming of the glory of killing the evil foes of the great empire of the Order. They enjoy the adoration of the populace when they join the army to go off and fight the frightful wickedness and sin that was said to infect the new world. Richard was horrified to see the numbers of people living in the old world, because it meant that the Order's army already in the new world was hardly a drain on the populace, and only the beginning. He had thought that perhaps the Order might lose their enthusiasm for a war conducted so far from their homeland, or that the people of the old world would tire of the hardship necessary to conduct such a war. He now knew that thought had been but a feeble daydream. It didn't take a wizard or prophet
to know that the armies the new world could raise, even given wildly optimistic conditions, had no hope whatsoever of prevailing against the millions upon millions of soldiers Richard had seen pouring north, to say nothing of the ones he hadn't seen who would be taking other routes. The Midlands was doomed. Ever since the people of Andorith chose the Order over freedom, he had known in his heart that the new world was going to fall to the Order. He felt no satisfaction in realizing how right he had been. Seeing the size of the enemy, he realized that freedom was lost, and resisting the Order was but suicide. The course of events seemed irrevocable. The world lost to the Order. The future for him and Kaelin seemed no less hopeless. By far the strangest place he and Nikki had visited in their journey southeast, a place she never spoke of afterward, had been less than a week south of Tanimura. Richard had still been in a dismal mood thinking about the carvings he had seen, when Nikki took an old, seldom-used track off the main road. It led back toward the hills, to a rather small city beside a quiet river. Most of the businesses had been abandoned. The wind at will carried dust through the broken windows of warehouses. Many of the homes had fallen to ruin, their roofs caved in, weeds and vines doing their best to bring down crooked walls. Only the homes on the outskirts were still occupied, mostly by people raising animals and farming the surrounding land. On the northern side of the city, one small store remained to sell staples to surrounding farmers. There was also a leather shop, a fortune teller, and a lonely inn. In the center of town stood the bones of buildings, long since picked clean by scavengers. Several of the buildings still stood, but most had long ago collapsed. Richard and Nikki walked through the center of town, watched only by a fitful wind. At the southern edge, they arrived at the remains of what had once been a large brick building. Without a word, Nikki turned off the road and marched deliberately into the forlorn site. The wood beams and roof had been consumed by fire. A thick mat of weeds and brush were devouring the wood floor. The brick walls were all that was left, really, and they were mostly fallen to rubble, with only a portion of the east wall still tall enough to contain a lone window frame. The wind ruffled Nikki's sunlit hair as she looked down the length of the skeletal remains of the building. Her arms languid at her sides, her back not quite as straight as it usually was, she stood vulnerable where once a roof would have sheltered her. For nearly an hour she was lost among the ghosts. Richard stood off to the side, leaning a hip against the charred remains of part of a workbench, one of the only things left inside the brick frame. "Do you know this place?" he finally asked her. She blinked at his question. She stared into his eyes for a long time, as if he, too, were a ghost. She stepped close to him then, her blue eyes finally looking away to let her fingers reminisce as they glided lightly over the remains of the workbench. "I grew up in this town," she answered in a distant voice. "Oh," Richard gestured around them. "And this place?" "They made armor here," she whispered. He couldn't imagine why she would want to see such a place. "Armor? The best armor in all the land. Double-proofed standard. Kings and noblemen came here to buy armor." Richard gazed around at the ruins of the place, wondering what more there must be to the story. "Did you know the man who made the armor?" Her blue eyes seeing ghosts again, she shook her head. "No," she whispered. "I'm so sorry, but I never knew him." A tear ran down her cheek to drip off her smooth jaw. She seemed very much a child at that moment, alone in the world and frightened. Had he not known what he knew about her, Richard would have put his arms around this forlorn, frail child and comforted her. Chapter 45. Nikki was tired, cold, and impatient. She wanted a room. Her purpose in guiding Richard to the center of the Empire in Aaltoerang was to bring him face to face with the righteous cause of the Order. She knew Richard to be a man of profound moral integrity, and she wanted to see how he would react when confronted by the undeniable virtue of his enemy's intentions. She wanted Richard to learn how difficult it was for ordinary people to live, to get along in the world. She was curious as to how he would fare in the same circumstances. She wanted to throw him into the fire and see how he reacted to the heat, as it were. She had expected him to be agitated and frustrated by now. He remained cool and unruffled. She thought he would be furious at learning what he had to do to get a job. He was not. He had listened to that Mr. Gudgeon's fellow explaining the near impossible task that faced anyone wanting work. Nicky had expected him to punch the pompous official. Instead, Richard had cheerfully thanked him. It was as if the things he so naively stood for, so selfishly defended when she had known him before, no longer mattered to him. At the Palace of the Prophets, when she had been his teacher, every time she thought she knew how he would react, he did something she would never have anticipated. He did that now, too, but in a subtly different way. What before had been, in a manner of speaking, unorganized, youthful rebellion, had turned to the dangerous scrutiny of a predator. Only the chains around his heart kept him from turning his claws on her. When Nicky had first captured Richard, she had briefly seen standing in the window of his house a carving of a proud woman. Nicky had known, as sure as she knew night followed day, that Richard had carved it. It betrayed his unique vision, which she recognized. The statue was tangible evidence of a hidden side to his gift. It was a form of balance to his ability for war, yet she detected no magic in it. Knowing that Richard had carved it, Nicky expected that he would have been interested in the carving job offered him back in Tanimura. He turned it down. He became moody and hardly spoke for several days afterward. Whenever they went through a new city, she saw him taking in the statues and relief carvings. Since he too carved, she expected him to find such creations fascinating. He did not. She couldn't understand it. None were as finely executed as what he had carved, to be sure, but still they were carvings, and she thought he would be at least interested in them. She was baffled by his grim mood whenever he saw them. One time she had taken the two of them out of their way for no reason but to show him a famous city square and the heroic work of art proudly displayed there. It was her thought to bring him a bit of cheer at seeing such a widely heralded work. He was not cheered. Surprised, she had asked him why he appeared to so dislike the sculpture, called Tormented Vision. "It's death," he said with distant revulsion, as he turned away from the widely worshipped work. It was a grand scene of a group of men, some gouging out their eyes after having seen the perfect light of the Creator. Others of the men at the base of the statue who'd not blinded themselves were being mauled by underworld beasts. The keeper's minions shrank from the blinded men, wailing at what they had seen before taking their own sight. "No," Nicky said, trying not to laugh and thereby humiliate him for his unenlightened view. She sought instead to gently rectify his perception of the famous work by explaining it to him. "It's a portrayal of the unworthy nature of mankind. It shows men who have just witnessed his perfect light, and in so doing have thus been able to see the hopeless nature of man's depravity. That they would cut out their own eyes shows how perfect the Creator is, that they could no longer bear to look upon themselves. These men in the statue are heroes for showing us that we must not arrogantly endeavor to rise above our corrupt essence, for that would be sinfully comparing ourselves to the Creator. It shows that we are but faceless, insignificant parts of a greater whole of mankind, which He created. Thus no single life can hold any importance. This work teaches us that only the society as a whole can be worthwhile. Those at the bottom, here, who fail to join in with their fellow man and blind themselves, are suffering their grim eternal fate at the Keeper's hands. Do you see now? It honors mankind as the flawed creature he is, in order that we may see that each of us must devote ourselves to the betterment of our fellow man, because that is our only means of doing good and honoring the Creator's creation, us. So, you see, it's not about death at all, but
but about the true nature of life.
Nikki had been taught that the statue was uplifting for the people, since it confirmed everything they knew to be true. In the whole of her life, no one had ever given her a look that made her feel smaller than the look Richard gave her. Nikki swallowed in horror at that look in his eyes. It was the complete opposite of that elusive thing she sought from him. Without saying a word, he had made her want nothing so much at that moment as to crawl under a rock and die. She couldn't fathom how, but he made her feel unworthy to live. In some bewildering way, that look made her feel as blind as the men in the statue. He hadn't said one word, but it was days before she could bring herself to look him in the eye again. Sometimes Richard seemed meek when she expected fierceness, and intense when she expected indifference. She was beginning to wonder if she had been mistaken in thinking there was something special about him. Once she had even given in to despair of there really being anything in him worth discovering. Watching him sleep, dejected that she had dared hope to uncover some meaning to life beyond what her mother had taught her, she had sadly resolved that the next day, after visiting the place she had grown up, she would end the whole senseless undertaking and return to Jigang. After they went to her father's business, though, she had seen again that quality in his gray eyes, and knew beyond doubt that she had not been mistaken. This dance had only begun. As they marched down the dim hallway of a rooming house, she gestured for Richard to stand aside. Nikki wanted this room. She wanted to lie down where it was dry and go to sleep. She resolutely rapped her knuckles on a door that looked as if it might come apart if she weren't careful. She peered down at the register she had and then stuffed it in her pack as she waited for the door to be answered. The lodging house, like all the others they had been to, was supposed to let rooms to those new to the city. The emperor needed workers. In her mind, she imagined that this would be the place. She stared at the stain on the sickly green plaster. She imagined seeing the tea-colored stain in the shape of a horse's rump with its tail flicked up every day as she went about her life. She imagined Richard walking past the stain every day when he went to a job, and every night when he came home, just like everyone else had to do. Richard was watching the stairway beyond the door where Nikki again knocked. The stairs faced away. She couldn't understand why he watched all the things he watched, but she didn't discount his instincts. By the look on his face, he wasn't pleased about the shadowed stairway. Being a sister of the dark, she was hardly frightened by the simple things that frightened other people. She knocked again. A voice inside told them to go away. "We need a room," Nikki declared to the door in a tone that said she meant to have it. She knocked harder. "You're on the register. We want the room."
"It's a mistake," came the muffled voice from inside. "No room."
"Now look here," Nikki called out heatedly. "It's getting late." Three youths she hadn't seen sitting on the stairs swaggered around the newel post. The three were without shirts, showing off their muscles as young men were wont to do. All three had knives.
"Well, well," one of the youths said with a cocky grin as his eyes took her in with lewd intent. "What have we here? Two little drowned rats."
"I like the fancy tail on the little blonde rat," a second chortled.
Richard seized her arm and without a word shepherded her out the front door, back out into the rain. Nikki dragged her heels, protesting in a whisper the whole way. She couldn't believe that Lord Rahl himself, the seeker of truth and the bringer of death, would be intimidated by three men, boys, really. As they descended the rickety front stoop, Richard lifted an eyebrow at her while tipping his head close.
"You have no power, remember. We don't want this kind of trouble. I'd not like to get knifed over a room. This fight isn't worth it. Knowing when not to fight is just as important as knowing how." Nikki wanted the room, but she finally conceded that Richard was probably right. The three sneering youths slouched at the door and watched, laughing, calling Richard names. So far, they weren't interested in going out in the rain. She had seen young men like them before. This latest crop was no different from any of the others, arrogant, aggressive, and often dangerous. At least they made good soldiers for Jigang's army. Richard hurried her along the street. He cut through some of the narrow passageways, taking several turns at random just to be sure they wouldn't be followed. The city of Alturang seemed endless. In the overcast and rain, visibility was limited. The haphazard streets and byways were a confusing maze. It had been many years since she had been here last. With all the order's efforts, the place still had fallen on hard times. She feared to think of what it would have been like had the order not been here to help. When they emerged on a wider street, they found shelter under a small overhanging roof, along with a small group of others trying to stay out of the rain. Nikki hugged herself against the cold. Richard, along with the others, huddled under the roof, watched the occasional wagon making its way past on the muddy street. She didn't know how Richard could keep warm in such weather. She appreciated his warmth, though, when the small crowd pressed her up against him. Richard glanced down at her, seeing her shiver, but he couldn't bring himself to put an arm around her to help her keep warm. She didn't ask. Nikki sighed. The old world didn't stay cold for long. In another day or two, it would again be warm and muggy. When she had been at the crumbled remains of her father's business just before they left, Richard had looked as if he almost wanted to put his arms around her and comfort her. As much as he hated her, as much as he wanted to get away from her, he had been moved to sympathy. Standing in the ruins, Nikki had let the memories wash through her and had reveled in the exquisite anguish. Richard's eyes were fixed on something. She followed his gaze and saw that a wagon not far down the street was moving with an odd wiggle. Almost as soon as she noticed it, the wheel broke with a loud crack. With the strain imposed by the wagon slipping and being twisted in the ruts, the spokes had snapped under the heavy load. The side of the wagon bed dropped with a splash. People on the walkway were splattered with mud. They cursed the two men in the wagon. The four-horse team struggled to a halt as the uneven load broke the axle, causing the good rear wheel to snap its spokes too. The whole rear of the wagon collapsed into the mud. The two men climbed down to assess the damage. The raw-boned driver cursed and kicked at the broken wheel lying at a lopsided angle. The other man, shorter and stoutly built, calmly checked the rest of the wagon and its load. With a frown of curiosity, Richard nudged Nikki ahead of him as he moved down the street toward the wagon. She went reluctantly, unhappy to be out from under the roof. "We have to," the husky man said with a calm resolve. "It's only a short distance." The other cursed again. "It's not my job, Ishak, and you know it. I'll not do it." When Ishak threw up his hands in a helpless gesture, as his headstrong partner went to the front of the wagon and urged the team on, managing to drag the wagon to the side of the road and out of the way of the other wagons that were beginning to back up down the street. Once he had the wagon to the side, he started unhitching the team. The man at the back of the wagon turned and peered around at the people watching.
"I need some help," Ishak called to the sparse crowd.
"Doing what?"
a nearby man asked.
"I've got to get this load of iron to the warehouse."
He stretched his thick neck and pointed.
"Just there, in the brick building with the faded red paint on the side."
This is the end of Side 1. This program is continued on Side 2 of this cassette.